Welcome back. Hey, some great stories to be found in the news section at coasttocoastam.com. Check out these headlines. Curiosity captures incredible Mars panorama inside Amazon's artificial intelligence flywheel. And scientists discover planets in galaxies beyond the Milky Way for the first time. How about this one? Airbus self-piloted flying car just passed its first flight test, and how UFO reports change with the technology of the times. You can read these stories in their entirety in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Good job to webmaster Sean Latasseur. When we come back, The Octopus of Global Control. It's a controversial nonfiction book, occasionally hilarious, and it details how those in positions of power are able to manipulate society for their benefit, why they believe that they're entitled to impose their warped worldview of reality on mankind, and how we can break free from their grip. The eight tentacles of control that are wrapped around humanity are the military, governmental, covert, physical, financial, media, spiritual, and scientific. And this book tackles topics such as uncovering the deep state, false flag terror events, the media's role in manufacturing wars, the 9/11 deception, the fraud of central banking, and our broken education system. Charlie Robinson, my guest, when Coast to Coast AM continues, right after this. Charlie Robinson is the author of The Octopus of Global Control, a controversial and sometimes hilarious book that features the opinions of over 500 experts that expose and explain the century-long plan for world domination by the global elite. He had a front-row seat to the fraud and corruption in the mortgage industry during his 10-year career in Las Vegas real estate, and he credits John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, as the final piece of the puzzle that helped him to really see how the American government operates. Charlie Robinson, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
The Octopus of Global Control. The octopus, as it turns out, is rather an appropriate creature to sort of choose as the metaphor. I mean, we talk about, you know, the tentacles of control and so forth. But there's a lot more to the octopus than just eight tentacles or eight arms, I guess. It's a really appropriate creature to choose. Why is that?
It is. First of all, it's intelligent. It has the ability to camouflage itself multiple ways. Obviously, people, you see the stories of it spraying ink as a diversion to get out. It can change its color. It can also change its texture. So it has a lot of tricks at its disposal. It's intelligent in that, I guess the scientists will say that if it's been in a cave over the last 3 years, it remembers what the cave looks like. So it's smart enough to know when to stay and fight, and it has a very strong beak that will, you know, catch you off guard and rip you apart. So it is, it's not afraid to fight, but it's also smart enough to take off and fight another day. So that it seems like we've been dealing with some very intelligent people that maybe have maybe not our best interest at heart, especially over the last 100 years in this country.
And I guess then it's no accident that the producers or the creators of James Bond, that franchise, chose also at least I thought it was an octopus, to represent their criminal organization in the film Spectre.
Yeah.
Although when I have a Spectre t-shirt, and actually I counted the legs, there's only seven legs on that octopus, so I'm not sure exactly what happened there. I think that was more for aesthetics, that they had to get rid of one of the legs, but as far as I'm concerned, it's an octopus.
I don't think it's any surprise that Ian Fleming was a MI6 agent as well, so I think that maybe some of his stories weren't maybe as fictional as you'd like people to believe.
Ah, we should also point out, or I also want to point out, that this book, writing this book and accumulating some 500 quotes from various witnesses and participants that were, again, involved in some of these important events in our history, this writing this book almost cost you your marriage. Explain.
Yeah, when I decided to write the book, I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my wife, I didn't tell my mother, I didn't tell my friends. I just quietly set about writing it at night when I could here and there. And I just decided that I would keep doing it and see how it goes. If I feel good, I'll keep writing it. I'm not going to set myself, I'm not going to tell everyone, hey, I'm writing this book, and then have people ask me later, hey, how's that book? And I said, oh, I didn't, you know, I decided to, you know, not finish it or anything. So I just was quiet about it. And the more I wrote, the more compelled I was to just continue writing, and I felt like it was getting pretty good. I didn't want to say anything, though. I really just wanted to put it all together. I didn't feel like, you know, let's face it, the topics in this book are kind of heavy. Not exactly fun dinner conversation. So I wasn't really in a position where I felt like I could share the stories openly. So I kept them to myself. I quietly wrote it, put it all together, and sent it off and to be published. And I thought I was at home to intercept the package, the first box with the books in it. And I got the mail that day, but apparently the UPS delivered afterwards. And I got a call from my wife, who had gotten the package and opened it up and found a 520-page book in there, and with my name on it and my picture on the back. And she threw me out of the house.
Oh, dear.
She was not impressed by the book. She considered that to be me sort of sneaking around behind her back. I tried to say, listen, I mean, you know, there's lots of women that find their husband's been cheating or has some double life, or I have a wife and kids in another state. I just wrote a book. That's all. She didn't seem to find the
How long did it take for her to get over it?
It took two days before I came back. Yeah, I had to explain, listen, I just wrote the, you know, I felt compelled to do it. It's very hard to explain this, but it mattered to me. The topics of the book mattered. I'd been familiar with these issues for a while, and I felt like I brought something to the table in this book that others didn't, and that was the ability to kind of take these really dark topics and infuse some humor into it. And I did that in two ways. One was that I just have a naturally kind of twisted sense of humor. These things are awful. A lot of the things that happen in the world are terrible, and it's not, you know, and I can make light of them, not because I don't care, but because you got to laugh or else you'll be crying. So that was one component of it. Another was that I thought it was really important to hear the words of people that were there, people that were involved in it, people that had some hand in it, or in other cases, comedians. Like George Carlin is one of the greatest philosophers of all time. Of course, you know, he's considered to be a comedian, but you watch his stuff now and look back on the things that he was talking about in the, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, he's right on. So to take the quotes, to take from people that were involved in it was important. And then to get other people's, you know, opinions, people that had viewed these events and had something funny or some added something to it. And I compiled this together in a way that made sense to me. And I put it out there. And so far the response has been pretty good, except for my wife. But I'm working on that. So
she's coming around. I mean, she must be proud.
I mean, listen, look, if the people listening tonight want to buy the book, I mean, that would certainly help me out. It's available
right
on Amazon. So, you know, by all means.
The Octopus of Global Control, Charlie Robinson. If you'll permit me, I want to share one of the quotes that's included, and there are over 500. And this is a very interesting way to put this book together, is to include all of these quotes from in many cases, power brokers and people in positions of authority, and yet they're talking about some level of government above and beyond them, exercising, you know, or with their, the unseen hand, I guess, on the levers of power. Here's one from 1922, and it's the mayor of New York City, John Francis Hyland. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques, which comprise the invisible government. It operates under cover of a self-created screen and seizes our executive officers, legislative bodies, schools, courts, newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. And as you write in the book, nothing really has changed in the interceding, almost 100 years. But that's the former mayor of New York, John Francis Hyland, in 1922.
If you took his name out and you replaced it with somebody that's more, current, somebody that is currently in politics, it'd be the same story. I mean, nothing has changed here. If anything has changed, it's even more under the control. The media, the mainstream media, has been, I mean, they're just ineffective and completely worthless, and they're paying the price for that. I think you can see ratings for TV news is, in the toilet, not getting any better. And, the media is dying, and they brought it on themselves, so.
The other quotes that jumped out, and you can share then this one. I think the one I'm talking about. It is the late David Rockefeller, who just passed away, I believe, earlier last year, and he made some pretty startling revelations and admissions as well about the New World Order and his involvement in it. I think you know the quote I'm referring to.
Yes, you want me to read that one?
Yes, please.
Okay, so this is David Rockefeller. This is in 2002 in his memoirs, or his autobiography called Memoirs. For more than a century, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidents to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, a one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it. I
And is
mean, when David Rockefeller tells you in his autobiography that his plan is to rule the world, you should probably listen to him. I doubt he got misquoted, unless it was Charles Barkley, who's the only person that I know who got misquoted in his own autobiography. So David Rockefeller has been accused of these things because he's guilty of them, not because there's some conspiracy in the media or these people have problems with. He's being accused of these things because he's doing them, or he did them until he died this year. And he doesn't care if you know it. And that should be alarming because there used to be a time when they wanted to keep this under the radar. They didn't really want the people to know. I think they're at the point now where they don't care. You're not going to do anything about it. You're not going to be able to stop them. So, here it is. And there's also some really weird component of this where it is as if they call their own shot, if they announce what they're doing, it's as if they have absolved themselves from any bad karma. It's sort of like they've put it on you. Now, I told you what I was going to do, and you did nothing about it. So that's on you, is sort of this philosophy. And you see that. You see that in sort of subtle symbolism and things that have you watch over the years. You can see it on TV. You can see the symbols that people use, and it is sort of a coded way of saying, this is what we're up to. And I don't know exactly the ins and outs of how that all works, but it appears that they have some sort of karmic code that they must follow. We're going to tell you what we're going to do, and then if you do nothing about it, then that's your problem.
You credit John Perkins, who has been
Yeah.
on Coast to Coast a number of times, the
Sure
author
do
of
have.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman. What specifically
Yeah.
did you learn from John Perkins that sort of cemented your worldview?
Well, I was just about to head out on a scuba diving trip in Thailand, and my friend Andy had this book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and he just gave it to me. He said, you should read this. Okay. So as in between dives, I'm sitting on the deck. I start to read this book, and I mean, I just couldn't put it down. I don't. I. It was so fascinating to me. Now, I had understood that 9/11 was not what it appeared, and I understood that there were false flag attacks, and I got that. But what I didn't really put together was the economic component of it, how you would take non-government companies, and he worked for a company called Maine, which is like sort of like a Halliburton or a Rand or what a multinational engineering firm that would go into foreign countries, pitch their services, hey, we'll build you a hydroelectric power plant, this will be great, you'll have electricity, your cities will have lights, your kids can read books at night, and all this great stuff. And they set this up in a way that it was economically never going to pay itself off. It was designed to enslave, to entrap this country in debt. Now, the money was never actually given to the country itself. It was funded by the World Bank, and it was given directly to the engineering companies to build these. So the money all got recirculated between the people in charge, and it enslaved the country that fell into that trap. And then they were, you know, they said, well, it's like, you know, like a loan shark. Hey, you know, you owe me a lot of money, so let's see, what can we do? You know, I'll, I don't know, sell us your, privatize your lumber industry and sell it to us, or, you know, let me get a hold of your fishing rights, or let me, you know, vote our way in the next UN resolution. So to read John Perkins' book about that, as someone who was involved in it and felt obviously clearly had a ton of guilt about it, it made, it just clicked for me. It just made sense. The whole World Bank, IMF, things like that, you know, these organizations that pretend to be for the people, the United Nations, probably the biggest culprit, but they, you know, they pretend to be for the people, and in actuality, they are most definitely not on the people's side. So yeah, it was an eye opener, and that book, it changed my life.
There are obviously, countless quotes from people who were in power, you know, Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli of Great Britain and Woodrow Wilson and Dwight Eisenhower. And we all, of course, are familiar with his famous farewell address and talking about the military-industrial complex. But near the very beginning of the book, you include a very telling quote from none other than astronaut Neil Armstrong. Tell me about the quote and why it's important.
Oh, boy. Well, with... I have to say, look, I love the idea of the moon landing and everything with that. I am told that I was named in part for Charlie Duke. So I have a picture of that was sent to me from Charlie Duke. You know, I hope your life is as interesting as mine. So I have this attachment in this pride in the moon landing and all of the stuff that comes with it. And I had never been one to really even dig too much into that, but. And I got to say, the more I look into this, the more questions I have. So you get Neil Armstrong. And the one part that made me just question everything the most was the really peculiar conference when they came, when Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, Neil Armstrong come back from being the first people to walk on the moon. And it's the three of them at a table, and they're speaking to a crowd of people, and obviously the media, and there's cameras there. Now, these three guys have just come back from the most impressive thing in the history of mankind, and they look like hostages. They look like Neil Armstrong looks like he wants to throw up. Buzz Aldrin is just fidgeting with his pen, and he is – those guys don't want to be there. And that is a, that doesn't prove anything, but that is just a very unnatural reaction to that. So you look into this a little bit more, and you see, you realize that Neil Armstrong basically became a recluse after that. I think all three of those guys had alcohol problems, and I'm not trying to make light of that. That's a big deal. But if you were pretending to be somebody that you really weren't, I could certainly understand why you'd want to drink. But Neil Armstrong had a quote in 1994, one of the few times he came out and actually spoke publicly. He said, "Today we have with us a group of students among America's best. To you, we say, we've only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers. There are places to go beyond belief." I don't really know what he's trying to say there.
But... uncover truth's protective layers, indeed. We'll pick up on that point when we come back.
Well, you know, if I had to say to you, what is the answer? I would say massive bloodshed. I really would. I don't really, honestly, deep down, believe in political action. I think the system contracts and expands as it wants to. It accommodates these changes. I think the civil rights movement was an accommodation on the part of those who own the country. I think they see where their self-interest lies. They see a certain amount of freedom seems good, an illusion of liberty. Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Yo, I voted." The limits of debate in this country are are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized and made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person, a kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Well, some rather candid remarks on conspiracies from the late comedian, philosopher, George Carlin. We'll get back to my conversation with Charlie Robinson, the author of The Octopus of Global Control, in just a minute. Just want to let you know what George Norrie is up to these days. Some more live events coming your way, including the invasion of Salt Lake City. That's happening at the Gene Wagner Theater in Salt Lake, Saturday, March the 10th, from 5 to 8 p.m. He'll bring along some amazing guests, including ancient technology expert Jason Martell, the man who died two times and lived to tell about it, Danian Brinkley, ufologist Nick Pope, and of course, George will sing a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in a Q&A with each guest, and there'll be a meet and greet following the show. So you don't want to miss out. Tickets are going fast. You want to call the box office at 801-355-2787. That's 801-355-2787. Online tickets available at artsaltlake.org. Artsaltlake.org. Back with more of The Octopus of Global Control right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We are back with Charlie Robinson, the author of The Octopus of Global Control. And Charlie, just before the break, we were talking about that Neil Armstrong speech delivered at the White House, and it was celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing, so July 20th, 1994. Let me just set that up again, and I just wanted to drill down a little bit further on his comments. Again, this is Neil Armstrong. He says, "Today we have with us a group of students among America's best. To you we say we have only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers. There are places that go beyond belief." And then you ask, rhetorically, what protective layers, Mr. Armstrong, are we to remove, the truth or the lies? Is it possible that what he was saying, that it was just sort of an innocent, kind of a positive comment that, we have to... We have to pursue the truth. Sometimes it's a bit of a struggle, but it's not necessarily. He's not necessarily somewhat surreptitiously admitting that we didn't go to the moon, is he?
If it was Buzz Aldrin that said this, I would not think much of it. But the fact that Neil Armstrong didn't speak publicly very often, when he did, everything he said was picked apart and magnified. He made a comment at one time talking about how we were, describing themselves as parrots. We were good at saying things, but not very good at flying. I mean, was that some sort of like veiled comment about their inability to get to the moon? I don't know. I have to confess that I want that whole moon landing story to be true. I really do. I think it sounds great. It's great as an American, and it's just a magical thing to be able to do that. The more I look at it, the more I have really big concerns. And part of it is because, in terms of science, you sort of build on what you've done in the past. We just stopped going to the moon all of a sudden and then didn't go anywhere else. And now when you listen to NASA, NASA puts out videos talking about their Orion project. We're gonna figure out to go past the Van Allen belt. Well, hang on a second. You supposedly went past the Van Allen belts on seven different occasions, once there and once back. So if you were able to do that in the late 60s in this equivalent of a Volkswagen Bug going to the moon, and now here we are 50 years later, you can't do that anymore. And their answers for that, their explanations for that are pretty weak. It's, well, we used to have that technology, but we destroyed it and we just can't go. And you're like, no, I'm sorry, that's not going to work. For $5 trillion, you're going to have to give us a better answer than that. Why don't we have a base on the moon? Do we have a base on the moon? I don't know. I mean, I just know that the more I hear NASA talk, the less I believe them. And that's a shame because I don't like feeling that way, but that's just when I take a step back and look, you know, try to be objective about it, I just don't have a whole lot of respect for them.
I guess that's why some people joke that NASA stands for never a straight answer.
Never a straight answer. Yeah. And by the way, I think in case anyone cares, it also was technically started by Nazis. I mean, it was through Operation Paperclip. All the German scientists, the rocket, Wernher von Braun, and the people leaving Germany were taken and given a pretty sweet deal to come to the United States and work on the rocket. Rocket propulsion systems and all of that. And so when people joke that NASA was sort of, you know, founded by Nazis, it's actually an accurate statement. It really was. So
I was trying to remember whether it was All the Right Stuff, that movie, which was mm-hmm. about the space race, and one astronaut, American astronaut, is asking another whether the United States will beat Russia to the moon, and he says yes because our Nazis are better than their Nazis, or something like that. I might be paraphrasing. I want to also ask you about this. I don't know if this surely must be in the book. I can't seem to find it, but it's of course the John F. Kennedy speech before the American Association of Newspaper Publishers, and many listeners will be familiar with it. Kennedy says the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are as a people inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. What do you think he was on about? Because I've heard other people explain that away, that he was actually talking about the communist threat. What do you think Kennedy was referring to when he was talking about secret societies and secret oaths?
I don't know for sure. I mean, I know that was what the cover was. Well, he was talking about communism and things like that. I don't know. I think that I think that maybe he was trying to let people know that there's I mean, part of that speech, he goes on to say, you know, I intend to change, fix, or something along the lines of, I intend to fix this, as you know, as long as, you know, for what's underneath my control, you know, what I'm able to change. I think that he was trying to, I think he was elaborating on what Eisenhower was saying on his way out, which was, you know, to be careful of the unwarranted and influence of the military-industrial complex. They were starting to grow. I think that that they were becoming an enormous threat, and I think that maybe Kennedy wanted to make that public. I don't know, though, for sure. I mean, there's so many thoughts on who actually had a reason to kill him. It seemed like there was everybody. He seemed to make a lot of people upset. To me, I find that fantastic. That's great. The more those people are feeling uncomfortable and upset, the better, as far as I'm concerned. So if it was the CIA or if it was the Cubans or whatever, I felt like Kennedy seemed to do a really good job of pissing a lot of people off, and that's a good thing.
That Schopenhauer quote, a very famous quote, the truth goes through stages. First, how does it go now? First, it is violently opposed. No, first it's ridiculed, then it's violently opposed, and then is it accepted as self-evident?
Yeah.
So first it is ridiculed, then it is violently opposed, and then it is accepted as self-evident. What stage do you think the planet is in terms of the truth? Are we in the ridicule stage, the violently opposed, or is it becoming self-evident?
Let me answer that question with a quote from somebody that I'm sure has been on your show before. Stephen Bassett, he's the executive director of Paradigm.
Oh, yes, yes.
He's got a great quote, and this is in one of the first couple pages of the book, because it is just, he just nails it. So he says, imagine if the truth was a huge jigsaw puzzle, a big box with 20,000 pieces, and it is the truth, the absolute truth. It is a picture of the world as it really is. You come into this world, you get an education, you're handed this box, and the idea is to put all the pieces together. And if you put the pieces together on this huge table, it will be the truth about the world that you live in. So you set about to do that. All good, a wonderful thing, except there's a problem. It turns out the government that you were living under has made a decision to interfere with this truth process. It's a political decision being made for political reasons to serve the state, almost never the citizens. So the government has taken a whole bunch of those pieces out of your box and has thrown them away. They're missing. Well, that's a problem, but it gets worse. They've grabbed a bunch of pieces from another box, another puzzle, and thrown them into your box, to your puzzle. And now you have to put this thing together with an idea that what you're going to find is the truth. That is an almost impossible situation, and it is extremely effective to serve the state. I think we have a bunch of pieces that we're trying to put together, and they just might be from different puzzles.
When you talk about the octopus of global control, what are we really talking about? Are we talking about one octopus? Is that octopus one person? Is it? Are there several competing octopi? and let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what is your feeling on where the power center? You know, is it one person? Is it a group of people? Is it a committee of 300?
It is. I'll tell you what it isn't. It isn't limited by nationality. So it is a group that is less concerned with boundaries. They're not necessarily American. They might be European. It's a combination of people that have come together to put a plan that benefits them. Catherine Austin Fitz says this. One of the things that are interesting about reading conspiracy theory is that much of what folks think is a conspiracy is really many people acting in concert to make or protect their money. So is there a big meeting where everybody comes together to find out what the plan is? I doubt it. I know there's Bilderberg meetings. I know there's the Committee of 300. There's all of these different groups. But at its core, that meeting doesn't need to happen because the people that are in charge know what they need to do to make sure that they stay in charge and that what benefits them. They don't have to go to a meeting to get briefed on what it is they need to do. They know. So probably at the core of it all is the control of finances, and that would be the banking. Mm-hmm. The banking system, as Americans, we grow up in the banking system and they say, oh yeah, take your money and you put it in the bank and you get interest on it. And then, you know, but over time and, you know, inflation eats away at it and everything. And it's just sort of taught to us as if that's normal. And that's not normal. That doesn't have to happen. You know, before the central banks were put in place, there wasn't inflation. If you had a dollar in 1913, it's worth 4 cents now. You know, so that is a product of central banks. And it's done because they take the money, they loan it out to countries. The countries have an interest, have a financial interest in making sure that they pay it back at a lower cost later. So as the inflation increases, the countries pay back the money at a discounted rate. So I think that what everyone sort of misses about this is that the countries are borrowing money from a central bank. The most obvious question is, why don't the countries print their own money? Well, they should, and they could, but they have been tricked into the central bank concept that's the way it has to be. And in 1913, the United States slit its own throat by passing the Federal Reserve Act. And it's no coincidence that in 1913, the IRS was also established at the same time, because the IRS is the collection mechanism for paying back the interest on the debt. The central banks create the money out of thin air. They loan it to the government at interest, and then they collect the interest as it goes on. You can cut them out of this whole process. The central banks don't need to be there. But they've done a very good job of keeping people ignorant about the way money works.
It's interesting here, up here in Canada, where I'm sitting, we're one of the few, maybe one of the only, certainly G20 countries that has a central bank that is owned by the people. It was nationalized by Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King back in the, I believe, the 1930s. And that we have a Bank of Canada Act, which allows provincial, municipal, and federal governments to borrow money from the central bank or the Bank of Canada. at zero or very low interest as a percentage of their overall budget. They can't just borrow any amount. And this is how this country built the great St. Lawrence Seaway. It's how we paid for our war effort during the Second World War. We didn't accumulate debt doing these things. It's how we paid for socialized medicine and different welfare programs initially. And then in the 1970s, that all stopped. We stopped borrowing from the Bank of Canada, even though the Bank of Canada Act still exists. So it's very interesting, as you say, how we become enslaved to this money that is created out of thin air as debt. And the vast majority, 90-some percent of the accumulated debt, at least in this country, is compound interest. And yet we could borrow from the Bank of Canada if we wanted to, but we won't. Why not?
We like to put our wars on credit cards, you know, because what could possibly go wrong with that?
How do you keep from getting cynical? How do you keep from letting this sort of just eat away at you and coming to this conclusion that this octopus, it has it all locked down. There's nothing we can do. We're powerless. It's too late. I'm just one person. You know, I might as well just crawl back into bed.
Well, there is one thing that the masses have in their favor that they don't typically remember is that, you know, we outnumber them by a substantial amount. If the population of United States, of any country really, if the population decides collectively that they want to change something or they don't want to, they can do it. There is a very easy way, or maybe not easy, but there's one way that you can get what you want when you have a lot of people. You just do not comply. If there is a law that you feel is unjust, if a couple of you are breaking it, you're going to go to jail. If everybody collectively stands up and says, we're not doing that, we're done with that, then you watch the power shift. It leaves their hand. It comes back into to the people. The people have been trained. This is not an accident. They have been dumbed down. They have been trained to think that they don't have power. It's tempting to want to crawl back in bed and just say, oh, forget it. I'll let somebody else deal with it. So the way I think about it is I try to have some fun with it. I try to see the humor in it. You and I have talked before and mentioned that one of my sort of better known comments in the book was that we have gone from a country of big dreams and new ideas to a country of motorized scooters and bad decision makers, circumnavigating the local Walmart like Magellan with tankles, compression socks, and an oxygen tank. I mean, if your trip to Walmart doesn't crack you up, then, I don't know what will.
That's one of the best quotes in the book, and it happens to be yours. yeah, I enjoyed that. And I wanted to share an email I got from a regular listener who emails me quite often. I'll just call him Dr. Ed. He's in California. I'm just going to kind of crib it here a little bit. He says, the planetary frequency is too high now to sustain that old world domination mentality. And as will be evident as the months go by, the swamp will continue to drain. The exposure of truth will intensify, and the elite's longtime control structure or tentacles will continue to dissolve. Well, that's kind of a positive outlook. I like that, Dr. Ed, and I'll get to Charlie Robinson to respond when we come back.